Well, good evening, everybody. This is Patrick Milliken from the Poison Pen Bookstore in Scottsdale, Arizona. Thanks for tuning in to another virtual event, and really, really looking forward to this one. Dwyer Murphy, we had a chance to visit last year. Was it about a year ago, or is it more than that?
No, I think it was almost exactly a year ago. Yeah,
same year, same time. Yeah, last year. And it's kind of apocalyptic here in Phoenix. We were just talking about that, but we're inside and the AC is working, so we're good. But last year we met to discuss Dwyer's wonderful novel here, just out in paperback, In Honest Living. And today we're going to be talking about the brand new book, which is called The Stolen Coast. And boy, what a wonderful book. So much fun. And we're going to do a deep dig on this book without giving away too many spoilers. But Dwyer kindly signed a batch of books for us. And I am flying solo tonight. I'll try to put a link in the comments field on Facebook and YouTube if anybody wishes to purchase one, or you can just give us a call toll free at 888-560-9919. So commercial plug out of the way, but if you don't buy it from us, get it somewhere, because you're going to love this book, both of these books. And I should say, let me just read this. Dwyer Murphy is the author of An Honest Living, which I just mentioned, which was a New York Times Editor's Choice, a New Yorker Best Books of 2022 selection, and a finalist for the Gotham Book Prize. I didn't know that. That's great. He's the editor-in-chief of Literary Hub's Crime Reads vertical, the world's most popular destination for thriller writers, and was previously an emerging writer fellow at the Center for Fiction. But they didn't teach all the good stuff out of him.
So, well, thank you so much for having me. Really, I feel like it doesn't seem like it was a year ago that we spoke, because maybe I'm just looking forward to this so much, but it's a chance to really dive into some of the particular types of crime fiction that I love with a fellow aficionado. So thank you for having me. This is a real treat.
Absolutely. And yeah, we are both, you know, aficionados or just rabid fans. And you know, it's funny, this book, we'll get into it. You can tell us a little bit about the particular area where it's set. Maybe you could describe that a little bit.
Yeah, I just arrived here an hour ago, so I'm thick with atmosphere, as it turns out. I'm right back in the middle of it. It is set in a small town in southern Massachusetts. It's on the south coast of Massachusetts, which is a different part of the state that even a lot of people who are from Massachusetts are maybe a little unaware of. But very distinct pocket of New England that is populated by a lot of small communities, beach communities, places that used to have fishing fleets but don't anymore, a lot of different ethnic and immigrant communities all mixed in together in these towns. And in this particular one, I've sort of created a stylized, romanticized version of one of these tiny little beach towns. And in my version of it, I imagined that it happened to be a hub for people who were trying to disappear. You know, there really are towns all around America that are kind of hubs for people who want to wash out of society and do something a little different, whether it's, you know, like a Galveston, Texas, or the Florida Keys, and these little coastal communities or desert communities where people who maybe just want to start over or do their own thing or have a new name and a new life, they might gravitate towards those places. So I imagined one of these communities on the coasts of Massachusetts that I really love, in a town where, you know, it's a romantic version of the town where I grew up.
Oh, okay. I was going to ask that. Yeah. So it's called Onset, right? Which is a great
name. So Onset is a real village within the town of Wareham on the south coast of Massachusetts. We, our fictional romanticized version of Onset is a little bigger and a little different. We borrowed some of the geography and we kept the name because it's such a lovely poetic name for a place. You know, it's this tiny little pocket of the coast where it was originally kind of a summer retreat for Wampanoag tribes. And then later there were these groups of people called wreckers who, they would live in these small communities along the coast and scavenge after shipwrecks, and they would live off of some of the bounty of shipwrecks. And then later on, groups of spiritualists came during the sort of Victorian era, 19th century. And so it's always been this place for people to kind of to go live eccentrically and to do something a little different. And in my version of it, a lot of those people happen to be hustlers and schemers and jewel thieves as well, as you might find.
Well, and also, you know, the socioeconomic mix is very interesting, you know, because it's, you know, you got the Paulsons of the world. We'll get in and talk about him. And then you got working class, you know, fishermen.
Right. Well, this real town is situated. It's the town you have to pass through to get to Cape Cod, which I think a lot of people know is sort of has the connotations of old blue-blooded New England summer retreat wealth. And this is the town that's next to that place. And it's kind of hidden away, and it feels like a very different world in real life and in the fictional version that we've created here. It's a completely different world that happens to just be next to this other world. So I think that it's a different version of New England that I think a lot of people have been exposed to. And I'm kind of excited to get to write about some of that, even if mine is the crime fiction version of that place, that hopefully there's some kernels of truth to it that people will recognize as this very distinct part of New England that I love. I have a tremendous amount of affection for. And it is very different, that it's not like the Irish American Boston that you might get in a great Dennis Lehane novel or something. It's a very different piece of Massachusetts hidden away down on the coast.
You know, it's funny. It has, maybe it's because it has that heavy, you know, there's a big Portuguese community, right? Right.
Yep.
The book to me had, it's fun. I don't know if anybody's brought this up to you, but it had a Patricia Highsmith vibe to me in some ways.
I'm so glad. I mean, I wanted that bad, you know.
Yeah.
It was one of my favorites, but it's the sort of makeup of a lot of the towns down here. Portuguese is the biggest group, that sort of Portuguese diaspora, different generations and waves of Portuguese immigration, and a lot of families who've been here for many generations. And Cape Verdean Islands and Azores are also really large communities here. And a lot of it, people came during different waves of like the whaling industry or later the fishing industry, and they ended up here. And you have sort of this thick cultural presence that has mingled up in such an interesting way that is really miles apart from, you know, the patrician old world New England, and also from Irish American New England as well. It really is its own thing and very different.
I'm just going to read the quote, because Ace Atkins, you know, wonderful writer, I think
Ace probably is great, yeah.
Good friend of both of ours, but definitely the quote I thought was just so right on. He said, the morally ambiguous rogues, con artists, and thieves of the stolen coast would have most surely brought a smile to the late, great George V. Higgins, whose Friends of Eddie Coyle, you make a nice little reference to, at least the film version, which towards the end, which, folks, if you've never seen that, what a masterpiece. The book and the film, the Criterion Collection, is really great.
Yeah, you got it. I hope people will, maybe some people will be motivated to watch or read The Friends of Eddie Coyle, which is, I was thinking about the book the other day, because I love George V. Higgins, and he's from the same town where I was born, which is a little north of here, Brockton, yeah. And he was such a stylist, you know, that it was, I think the books were themselves really good crime fiction stories. And so I think people can forget what a kind of an experimental and interesting stylist he was. They're so full of dialogue and language, that book, and they capture a lot of that in the movie, I think, really well too. But you feel fully immersed in this world, because he's just throwing all these voices at you, and they're all kind of talking over and around one another, and it creates this really interesting effect, I think.
Right, absolutely. And that's just kind of when you can get, you know, like more than two characters, like three characters talking without any attribution, and you know exactly who's speaking, that's a good writer, you know.
Yeah, exactly.
It does that beautifully.
I love that. And they capture some of that too. I think the movie is just so cool. I mean, it's not it's not really a straight heist story, right? But it has a lot of that feeling to it too. There are bank robberies going on, but we're sort of following this odyssey through through these different dens of thieves in southern, just south of Boston, Massachusetts, in that era. It's so much fun.
I love kind of older Mitchum too. You know, he's
Oh man, that face.
He's that world weary. My favorite adaptation of Chandler is The Farewell, My Lovely, with him as Marlowe.
It's really good, isn't it? I just watched it again recently too. Yeah, I forgot how good that is.
Yeah, and fun fact, has that cameo by Jim Thompson.
Oh, I didn't know that. Wait, where does he show up in that?
You didn't know that?
No, I don't know this fact.
Well, which movie, one of the viewers asks, Farewell, My Lovely, it was made in the 70s. And, you know, Charlotte Rampling is just smoking hot in that movie. I mean, God, she's got that presence. But
I was watching Verdict the other day too, and she shows up with that. She's just scorching in that too.
Oh, man. Yeah. Angel Heart, even, you know, she's still got it. But sorry, folks, we're going to digress a bit, but we will get back to the book. In Farewell, My Lovely, there's a scene, you know, where Charlotte, the Rampling character, is, you know, married to the older man, and she's always fooling around on him. Well, you see a scene where Rampling and Marlowe are, I think they actually kiss on the couch, and the door opens and you see him look in. That's Jim Thompson.
Wow. Yes.
You got to go back cool. And look at that.
I'm going to look for it.
Great. And Harry Dean Stanton's in that movie. It's such a great thing. Anyway, back to the book. So let's see, how do we set this up? Let's just dive right in. Tell us a little bit about Jack, your character, and who he is and what he's doing in this town.
Yeah, so the main character, the narrator of this book, is a lawyer who, and I like shady lawyers. He's kind of a shady lawyer who, he works with his father, and they have a very particular business in this town where if you are a fugitive of any kind, you're on the lam, you're on the run, or you just want to start over and create a new life, you can go to this small town in Massachusetts, and Jack and his father will create a new identity for you, get you out of the country, start over somewhere else with any new credentials or visas or documents you might need. And they run this kind of service. His dad is an ex-spy, and Jack has been raised in the family business of moving fugitives, essentially, and hiding people and creating new identities. And so this town in Massachusetts, our fictional onset, is kind of a Casablanca style last exit town where everybody's hanging out waiting for their chance to start a new life as these few characters operate their business of shuttling in and out various fugitives and hustlers and crooks and gangsters that need a new life somewhere. And so this town is just kind of full of people with secrets, and they're all at peace and hanging out in the same bars and taverns. They've got their kind of version of Rick's Cafe, going to the beach and eating at the same pizza parlors. And so it was a lot of fun to write. I just love that kind of atmosphere. I've always been a little in love with the idea of Casablanca's, not just that one town, but these places where people go, sometimes a little desperate, sometimes not, and you know, exercise their world weariness together and try to get out and start over somewhere new.
Right. And earlier you were talking about how these little towns are great places where various eccentric characters are allowed to thrive, you know. And that reminded me a little bit about a little bit of some towns in the Deep South, you know.
Yep.
And so this would be kind of like New England Gothic, you know, where everybody's got a weird uncle that kind of lives up in the under the kitchen sink or something like that.
Right. Like, and that, you know, when you mentioned Highsmith before, I think it does feel to me part of the appeal is that it almost feels like it's a town full of expats in a way. Like this could be, you know, somewhere in Italy circa 1950s or something, just a place where a lot of different kinds of eccentrics have gravitated towards for their own respective reasons, and they want to kind of create something new for themselves and in this community as well. It was a lot of fun to write, and I got to, you know, I love Elmore Leonard as kind of my guiding light on all this stuff, and I got to create all these eccentric, talkative, you know, verbose characters who could walk around town talking about various various cons they might be running and schemes they might be running. I got to exercise some of my Elmore Leonard fantasies here.
Right. And to finish the quote that I abandoned halfway through by Ace, what I'm also meant to bring up, he says, there's so much to love here, including a setting that reminded me of the broken coastal towns with dark, dirty secrets that Robert B. Parker often wrote about.
I love the Robert B. Parker stuff too. And Ace obviously wrote the Robert B. Parker series for, has recently left it, but he did that such great justice too, that it was fun to get his seal of approval on that too. But I love the old Robert B. Parker stuff as well, and the old Spencers I kind of grew up with, because I was in Massachusetts, so my parents obviously had the TV show Spencer for Hire on all the time, and we had the books around the house, so it was fun to get to do my version of some of that.
Now, I don't believe you actually state the time. I don't think you define when it is. I mean, we assume that it's contemporary.
Yeah, I it's funny that you say that. It hadn't occurred to me until I just spoke with my parents when I arrived back in this area, and they asked me the same question. Yeah, I think it's kind of, we stuck it in this. It could be 50 years ago, or it could be today, but I think it's basically today. We mentioned phones a couple of times.
Yeah, you mentioned some burners and stuff like that.
Yeah, but I also like, because the main characters who sort of run this town, the lawyer and his father who are doing this, the father, as I said, is an ex-spy. So they're using a lot of old spy craft, meaning like circa 1970s and 80s spy craft as part of their business, because they like to keep it somewhat analog. It's a little safer that way. And so there are a lot of these little pieces of 70s and 80s spy craft that pop up alongside the iPhones, I think, in this book. But I just really like that era of espionage stuff too, because there was this over the top theatricality and this real physicality to the dead drops and the espionage of that era. So I've always been a little in love with that stuff.
Absolutely. Well, it's funny because we have a lot of writers that come through here all the time, and that topic has come up quite a bit. That in the in the espionage, you know, community right now, because you know of technology, and it's very difficult to for somebody to escape or to. You know, every block is on camera, you know, that it's so pervasive that there is a return to these old analog methods because they're more reliable, you know?
Yeah. And that's something, I mean, that was a big idea that I kind of wanted to explore in this book, because I think that something that is fairly universal is the appeal of the idea that need be, one might still disappear, right? Like, I think we all kind of have that fantasy sometimes that gets us through the day. Sometimes it's just, you know, in an odd moment, it might pop into your mind or you're on vacation somewhere, but you'd like to have the idea that you could disappear and start something new if you ever needed to. And so I wanted to imagine this town and how it might operate if everybody was gravitating towards it in order to do just that, right? And so the idea of some of these analog old-fashioned spycraft pieces works very nicely for that, because it's true that with technology today, it is a very different game trying to disappear. It's a subject that I'm very interested in and have always been. I was a lawyer earlier in my life, and my father worked in intelligence earlier in his life. And so it's always been a kind of a parlor game for us that we like to think about. If you need to go on the lam, or you need to get in the hideout, move across a border discreetly, how do you do it? We like to play that game out. My wife does that now too. We're a real committed family to that particular game. And there's all these old fashioned techniques that still work quite well when you're trying to disappear.
It would be a cash business, right? I mean, you don't want any cards. You don't want.
Exactly. And a lot of it too, when you're actually, if you need to immediately go on the run somewhere, a big part of it is you're never going to erase yourself completely. So it's more important, I think, there are different schools of thought on this, to create a lot of static, a lot of confusion around your identity and where you are. So one technique that you often might do, or if you had a private investigator doing this for you, is calling around all over the country and applying for various things that might stir up a credit check, for example, because you want to leave this lengthy history for whatever private investigator or spy or searcher is going to come looking for you. You want to create as much noise as you possibly can to have them running in circles, make as much work for them as you can. And that's kind of, you know, what it's part of the service that the father and son are offering here, because the truth is nowadays you're never going to wipe yourself off of the map, right? I'm sure that some people try it, but imagine it's almost impossible to do.
Yeah, well, I wanted to talk to you a little bit about research into this realm. You remember Breaking Bad, that Robert Forster character had provided very, very similar kind of service.
Exactly, yeah.
It's a spoiler, folks, if you've never seen it.
But, yeah, and I love that Granite State episode is so good and Breaking Bad too. I think that must have been in my mind at some point or another, because it hadn't occurred to me until after the book was already done that, oh yeah, that Forster character is offering something similar, right? I think they take him to New Hampshire to a mountain, and you know, he resettles him there, and I think he's on Saul's Rolodex or something. That's how they get out. But yeah, I like the idea of that service. And in my version, it just happens that everybody does it in the same town first. There's a way station where you have to go before you can jump off to your next location. And some of the people happen to like the town. It's a really nice place in real life. So I wouldn't be surprised if somebody who was starting over got a glimpse of it and thought, you know what, this is nice. I might stay here for a while instead.
Right. Now, did you read about WITSEC and some of those programs?
Yeah, so when I was a lawyer, it was something that I was quite interested in. I used to talk a lot with, I clerked for a federal judge for a while, and she had been involved in a lot of mob cases earlier in her career and had a lot of really good information for me at that time. But this was maybe a decade ago or something, about how those programs work. And it's interesting because famously, WITSEC always boasts of never having lost a client who stayed in the program. And that is true, that once the feds have moved you to a new life, you're almost certainly not going to get found, except if you can't stay in that new life. That's how they find them. It's almost always anybody who gets washed out of that program or found, or, you know, God forbid, murdered. It's because they went back to their hometown. That, you know, there's a really strong draw on a lot for a lot of us, that nostalgia, that sentimental. We can't quite give up our families. It's a big thing to ask somebody to do. So usually when if those people get caught, it's because they've decided that they want to, you know, they reach out to some old friend or relative back in their hometown, and that's when they get washed out. But it was an area that I was always interested in. So when I was a lawyer and had access to people who would know, I was constantly asking questions about relocation programs or extradition treaties and how these things work and how the extradition actually operates. I think a lot of people imagine that, oh, you need to go to a country where they won't extradite, we don't have an extradition treaty, which to some extent can be really helpful, but there are all these informal ways of getting somebody back from a country we don't have a treaty with. So there's different strategies again in schools of thought. I like to game out where I would go if I committed, or if I, let's say I was falsely accused of a crime, but I needed to, you know, turn fugitive tonight, where do I go and where do I settle? I like to play through that scenario a lot.
And out here in the desert, of course, there are a lot of, you know, there's a nice history of mobsters being identities out here. And it's funny because what you say is so true. And it's like, usually it's hubris, you know, their own, their ego can't handle being underground. You know what I mean? And so they fuck up and they, you know, they say the wrong thing and incriminate themselves. And
right,
it happens all the time.
I know. And it's funny, a lot of back in like the 70s and 80s, when they were doing like the RICO cases in New York, those early cases, they didn't even really need to bother with a formal witness protection. It wasn't like everybody who testified against the mafia got a completely new identity. Often they were just moving them to a different borough and, you know, give them a new name and a new apartment, and they probably weren't going to get caught. Nowadays, that might be a little different. But yeah, people, you know, especially in that criminal world, there's a reason why you were drawn to it in the first place. And a lot of those same forces might draw you back. So it happens all the time.
Right. Okay. So let's dig into it, the book a little bit here. I mean, you have this character, Elena, who comes back into Jack's world, into the town, seven years after she left. Is she kind of a female Ripley sort of character in some way?
That's a good point, because she's sort of an operator and she's a hustler, right? And in a lot of ways, Ripley, I mean, like when we meet him at the beginning of the book, that is, he's running small time IRS cons essentially, right? And he's a survivor, and he'll do whatever it needs to do. So yeah, that's
a reptilian sense about him, you know.
Right. With Elena, I'd like to think that she is kind of an artist. So the idea is that she is from this same town and kind of worked 7-8 jobs and did whatever she had to do and got herself out and started a new life in New York. But she's sort of a hustler, and she's got a crooked side that she has to express in some kind of artistic way. So she washes back up in this town 7 years later and kind of draws our protagonist, our narrator, into a scheme, and they can't trust one another. There are double crosses along the way, there are heists and triple crosses that come in, and they can't stay away from one another. I love that sort of idea of two people who are engaged in a heist or a scheme where every step of the crime is kind of another piece of their doomed courtship, but they can't get rid of one another. They're drawn to one another over and over again. And it was just a lot of fun to write. I love writing. You know, I kind of had the sort of characters from like Out of Sight in mind or something like that. I wanted some of that crackling electricity between them. Or I was watching a lot of old screwball comedies at the time as well. And I wanted them to have some of that, you know, that feeling that they hate one another. They know that they're doomed and bad for one another, but they can't give one another up. And that's part of their love, right? So she was a lot of fun to write. And I think for me, when I was writing the story, it really came alive when she appeared, I think in chapter 3 or something, she shows up, and I felt that same shudder of fatefulness coming when I was writing her.
And let me see here. I wrote down some stuff I was going to ask you about. When it goes back and forth in time a little bit. And one of the things I thought was really telling detail is that you go back and describe how they first met. And they first met when she was trying to scam him, right?
Yeah, their first meeting is, so part of Jack's work is he needs to keep tabs on all the open cottages and motel rooms and places that one could conceivably stash a fugitive for a little while in this town. And he's out to check out a new house that he had his eye on using for a client coming in. And she saw him coming in and poses as a real estate agent and lifts $500 off of him for the application fee and then kind of disappears. And it's just, she's somebody who, when she sees a mark, she has to take that mark down. I think, you know, it's a bit of the sting or something. She's got a little of that confidence artist streak in her that she's doing it for love of the game, I think. And they both kind of treat it as a game. There's some appeal to that. I like that kind of confidence schemer that who's doing it for aesthetic reasons in some ways, right?
Right. But he, you know, he is the ferryman, as right. Describe him, and you know, tell us a bit more about him. I mean, there's a sense that he's, in some ways, he hasn't reached his full potential in some way.
Yeah, so the idea in the book is that he is kind of a Harvard educated lawyer who's washed out of his legal career that he never really wanted to start, and has gone to work with his father running this this business. And to me, he's sort of he's a criminal. He operates in that gray morality zone, but he's sort of just a romantic, I think, who doesn't quite have enough outlets for his romanticism. And so he has a way of walking through this criminal world and seeing the poetic side of all of it. I think when I kind of started imagining him, I'd been reading a lot during the pandemic. For some reason, I got on a kick where I read every Alan First novel just in a row. So I was fully immersed in this world. If people haven't read them, they're these wonderful spy novels that almost all take place around 1938 in some European capital. And it's always an aristocrat or a lawyer or somebody who has one foot in the professional world and one foot in the bohemian world of that city who is drawn into the world of immediate pre-World War II espionage. And I found that there's nothing I love better than that murky, gray, licentious, morally ambiguous world of, you know, that nightclubs in Europe in that era and espionage happening at the right, just the right cafe in Paris. And I think that obviously comes back to my fascination with Casablanca, but I wanted to sort of capture some of that same atmosphere in a character who happens to be living in contemporary Massachusetts in this very particular milieu.
Right. Yeah, that period in the 30s, especially in, you know, in Germany, it's really interesting to think about Berlin kind of at the end of that Weimar period where it was just decadence and
right.
Anita Berber and this wonderful art expressionism. And of course, so much of the film noir style exactly. comes out of that, you know, all these German, Hollywood was thick with Germans in the 30s, you know?
Yeah, and you're right. I mean, I think almost all noir is sort of descended from a lot of the same aesthetics of that era and the art of that era, isn't it? So it's a natural fitting for me. And I also just like to write a lot of scenes that take place in bars and taverns and nightclubs. And I like to always make sure that there's a chanteuse singing into the microphone slowly in the background of any scene I'm writing. So I wanted to create some of that nightlife in this town too. And, you know, there is this really, this cool musical tradition of like mornas and fado from the Portuguese and Cape Verdean diasporas that are this great tavern music that's all about fate and doom and lost loves. And it's just, it's thick with romance and nostalgia. And so I got to kind of merge a couple of those things that I loved and make sure that there were, we probably got 5 or 6 different versions of a nightclub or a cafe where everybody's hanging around in these towns. And I love writing that stuff.
And you have, I was going to ask you about, what was her name? Vera Baptiste.
Yeah. So we've got kind of a Cape Verdean singer who appears as part of this kind of scheme towards the end. So as I was mentioning before, there's a very large Cape Verdean community in the south coast of Massachusetts, and in particular in the real life onset. And there are a lot of different festivals over the course of the summer. One of the largest ones is the Cape Verdean Festival. And I kind of merged the idea of the Cape Verdean Festival with some other Catholic and religious festivals and fishermen's feasts that happen over the course of the summer. And I merged them all kind of into one big 3 or 4 day fiesta that's happening with a lot of music and fried scallops and religious ceremonies through the streets. And I wanted there to be this feeling that the action, the heist, the cons are all culminating in the middle of this festival. And Vera Baptiste is sort of one of the headline singers of this of the festival that we have towards the end of this book.
Yeah, no, the atmosphere you create is just amazing. You know, as you say, it kind of takes this sort of frenzied vibe, kind of as all the pieces are starting to come together that we can't talk about. But,
it led me write more music and dancing too. I just love, and when we talk about the noir tradition, I love making sure that there's music around and that there are people dancing. I like that bit of strange pieces of life carrying on in the background as your crime unfolds. There's a really proud tradition of that in noir, right? I was kind of a lot of the, I was thinking of like the last scenes of Asphalt Jungle when he's in the diner watching the girl dance or something, you know, things, strange thing, physical things like that. I like for them to happen in the midst of this crime story.
There was that, oh gosh. I think it might have been the film version of Phantom Lady. Did you ever see that with Elijah Cook Jr. as the
drummer?
Megan Abbott. Megan Abbott, you know, who's one of the smartest people I've ever met in my life. You know, she was teaching something, or she gave a presentation about noir, and she pointed to that scene, and it's really worth looking at. Yeah.
There's nothing I love more than music or dancing in a noir. So I will. I got to do a lot of in this particular book. There's a lot of basketball as well, and for me, the basketball was another kind of stand-in for that physical. It's like dancing to me. So I got to. There's a lot of basketball and a lot of dancing happening around these scenes.
Right, right. Well, boy, there could be a good Crime Reads article on that. On
basketball and dancing. I know. We need to gather it all into one place. But I, you know, there is that nice physical aspect to noir too, and it's fun to write that stuff. It always is. So if you can throw all your characters together in a festival, then it's really perfect. It's for a writer, that's gold.
Right. Well, I wanted to ask you about the basketball. It's a good segue, because there are these pickup games that happen on, I think they're on a Thursday night, right?
Yeah.
And it seems like a very important device in the book, because all these, well, some of these characters who are hiding out for various reasons kind of gather, and in this strange dance in which they can't really reveal too much, and talk about that.
Well, I love pickup basketball. So I'll say that I love basketball of all forms, but pickup basketball, there's something pure and interesting to me about it. So I play as much as I can. I used to play all the time in New York, and I've recently got a new regular game in Miami that I love too. But I like the sort of improvised sociability of pickup basketball that I think reminded me a lot of the best part of a heist. I'm going to try to explain this without giving away too much, but this is a heist novel, and I think people will know that this has a strong heist component to it. And for me, the best part of a heist story is when you're assembling the gang and getting everybody together, finding out what areas of expertise. You're going to need a safe cracker, and you're going to need a getaway driver, and you're going to need somebody who's, you know, who can go behind and work with the tellers if you're working a bank. And you need all these very specific people. In Ocean's 11, they're always kind of jokingly creating all these new names of roles that you need in a heist, right? Until there's 11 of them. But I like that, assembling the team. And in pickup basketball, there are all these weird customs that unfold when you arrive at the playground, where everybody's sort of peacocking for one another and showing, you're kind of warming up, but you're also making sure that everybody else can see what you can do on the court. And you start to break off into teams, and nobody quite knows how it happens. Later, you're shooting to see who's going to get on to the next game. But at the beginning, you're just waiting for 10 guys to show up. And when they do, nobody quite knows how the teams form, but they do. There's something kind of strange and exotic about this process that I really enjoy. And it felt to me like it worked really nicely for this town where everybody has these secrets and their pasts, and they're kind of showing one another glimpses of who they are, but also keeping large parts of themselves secret and trying to feel one another out. Can I trust you? Can I not trust you? And a lot of that happens on the playground as well, when you're getting into the start of a pickup game.
That's great. I wanted to kind of ask you a little bit about, there was something that struck me that was, it may just be, I may be reading way too much into it, but it seemed like a real key part of the book. And I just wrote it down. It was an old theory of hers, how few individuals you encountered and how important it was to recognize and appreciate them as they passed you by. You know, this notion of the individual. Can you talk about that?
Yeah, so that's something that Elena tells our narrator when she's kind of luring him into working with her on this heist, it's something she reminds him of, a game that they used to play where they would try to bring one another, individuals, you know, the people who are originals, they're without mold anywhere else on the earth, and how few of them you might encounter in a lifetime. And when you've come across somebody who's a true individual that has something authentic and interesting to express about themselves, some, you know, artists, for lack of a better word, that you've got to recognize and appreciate them and respect them. So I think maybe when she says that, there's a scene where she kind of brings around another con artist that she's encountered in the wild, and she wants to bring him to Jack almost as an offering, that here you and I can see this man for what he really is and appreciate the artistry that's involved in all of his ridiculous con games and schemes. And yeah, exactly. There's a character who's kind of maybe posing, or maybe not, as a Venezuelan Spanish count / psychiatrist / confidence artist. And Jack and Elena are kind of two of the only people who could really appreciate this man's essence and just what an individual he is. But it's part of the seduction between Jack and Elena is remembering that they're kind of, they have this bond, they're sort of peers in a way, and they were maybe born to work together and try to pull off that one last heist before they start a new life somewhere new. But they know that they can't trust one another. So this is all Elena's kind of way of luring Jack in. But yeah, it is. It's a central kind of concept in this book.
And there's I think you already mentioned this, but another thing that stuck out was, in my experience, nearly all career criminals think of themselves romantically. That's interesting. Yeah,
I do. So in my life as a lawyer, you know, you can't get into too much about your clients and you don't want to talk about them, but it was something that struck me that I found that, as opposed to the people who were either dabblers or maybe somebody who just got in over their head and committed a crime, the people who are really, the few you come across who are determined, resolved criminals who had made a life out of this, a choice in some way, and kind of committed to that lifestyle, they often have a narrative built up around themselves and where they fit into this criminal world. And there are all these codes of conduct and things you do or you don't do, and matters of honor and respect between them. And there's a romance inherent in all of that. I think that's why, you know, a lot of those great gangland sagas, they're kind of doomed romances in a way, right? And it has been my experience that type of criminal necessarily has built up a certain romance to his or her narrative of their life and how it's unfolding.
Well, and also there's something to be said for, you know, having this very specialized kind of knowledge and skill that not everybody possesses, you know. I mean,
absolutely. Yeah. There, yeah. I mean, that's why I think a lot of us also enjoy these books and movies about heists in particular, right? There's something about that kind of thief that just the procedural aspect of it, you know, I'm thinking of now, like it just popped into my head, but like watching James Caan drill a safe at the beginning of Thief, like for, or any of these, or like watching the heist and like Rififi unfold, a lot of those French movies of that era did, you know, a half an hour, no audio, we're just watching the artistry, kind of the choreography of these things. But there's something about that very specific expertise that has an appeal to all of us, right? You know, you wonder what it would be like to have that talent. It does seem like an art.
Did you read, there's a great book by a Northern Irish writer named Richard O'Raw, and it's
exactly,
called The Northern Heist.
Yeah,
it's a great book, and I had a chance to do this kind of thing with him.
Oh, you did? That's fascinating. Yeah. Yeah.
And he was talking, you know, the novel, as you probably know, was based upon this very famous, at least there in Belfast, bank heist. And these guys got away with, I don't even remember, you know, millions of pounds. And they did it, and he was talking about it, and he's like, yeah, it was just poetry. You know, it was just brazen. You know, they went in, and I think they came out they posed as sanitation workers, I guess.
Right.
They came out with like these massive bags full of cash, just brazen, just walked right out. And then they went back in and did it again. And that was the poetry. You know, they went back and just said, and they got
There's
away.
Something fascinating about that type of criminal, right? Like, I think that we're all sort of drawn to these stories because, yeah, there's a poetry to it. There's an art to it. And the idea of somebody, a mind who could arrange these things. Now, I mean, often the reality of a theft is, you know, a smash and grab or something that's ill-considered and brutally executed, but we're drawn to that romantic, the Thomas Crown type, who can do it in a different way, whether it's, for money or diamonds or paintings or anything. It doesn't really matter what they're after. It's about the process and pouring their souls into that process, right?
Right. And the character Frank Paulson in this book, you know, he tell us a little bit about him. He's a summer resident of Gooseneck, and he's Elena's boss that runs a law firm.
Yeah, he's kind of from that blue-blooded New England that I was mentioning before, the sort of very old landed gentry descended down from the Puritans and think of themselves in some ways as the kings of New England. And he is sort of the target of some of these schemes and cons that are being run. And partly it's sort of a clash of culture story that he feels like, because he's from a certain type of old money tradition in New England, that he should be immune to matters of morality or vulnerability, and that you shouldn't be able to take anything off of him. So I think that appeals to the characters to see whether they can, right? That if there would be something very satisfying about pulling one over on that type of confident, secure, old money New England, and taking something off of that guy would be extra special, I think.
Right. And there's that, let's see if I could find it. I'll see if I can find it. There was a part that I marked where it talks about, it was about him representing, this larger con, that is accepted and allowed to flourish. And, he's just as morally compromised as,
Yeah, I mean, I do think that there's some truth to that, that a certain type of old money, I mean, it goes back to every great fortune founded on a crime, but there is this idea that once your money is old enough and your family's been doing it long enough, that your morally reprehensible behavior is no longer a crime, but is somehow seen as the pillar of a society. And there's something deeply offensive about that notion, I think, to the rest of us, right? But a lot of those people truly believe it. And so if you get a chance to rob them fictionally or not, I think you ought to take it sometimes.
Well, yeah, I mean, here in Phoenix, there are plenty of examples of that, and you there's this one particular character that I shouldn't name his name, but he was just this notorious con man. And you see, and this goes back to, there was an incident here in the 1870s where, have you ever heard of Don Bowles, this reporter? He was this guy, and I promise, guys, I will not digress too long.
Right here.
He was investigating corruption here in Phoenix and writing all these series of articles. And he was blown up in his car dramatically. And one of the characters he was investigating was this guy. And you see buildings around town, like an art gallery, sponsored by the blah, 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 blah foundation,
And of course, you see it, every town and city's probably got their version of that, right? And the rest of us who know the truth about these people, and we know, we can see through the bullshit and see what their morality is really built on. It's just, it's a day-to-day offense. And so I think, we like these types of stories where maybe that type of character is the target of a heist. There's something particularly satisfying about that, I think, for all of us.
Right. God, what more can we really say? Have you read much Thomas Perry?
Yeah, I was just talking about him yesterday as well. He's such a good writer. I think it was in the context of somebody who just really writes meticulous sentences, but I think that we've got some thematic overlap that he's interested in a lot of the same things I'm interested in as well, and is such a gifted writer.
Yeah, no, he's great.
It's always a chance to, like, with these books, you get to realize, sometimes you finish the book and then you realize these writers who've mattered to you so much that have worked their way into your fictional world as well. I mean, I think for me, it's funny going back to this book, it's just the process. It's been a while since I looked at it in some ways, and I remember suddenly just, oh, right, there was a piece of Elmore Leonard here. There's always, for me, a lot of it is Elmore Leonard working his way into these stories, but I come across chapters and think, ah, yeah, that was kind of where I had been reading, Get Shorty or something, and that this character somehow channeled a little bit of Get Shorty for me here. And it's always fun to remember who you're reading and why as you go right back to it.
Right. Let me just look in some of these questions that are coming in, and let's see. So I think you covered this a little bit, but Renee would like to know, where did you grow up, and where do you live now?
So I grew up in a town called Wareham, Massachusetts, on the south coast of Massachusetts, meaning just before you get onto Cape Cod. And I live in Miami now, on a small island off of Miami that has got its own kind of romance to it now, to me as well, because it's the entire island is pretty much South American expats who've moved to this island. And I get to sometimes travel through it feeling like I'm somewhere else. It feels like it's a very rich expat community that I get to explore. So I'm new to Miami, and I had been in New York for 15, 16 years before that. But it's fun to be back in Massachusetts now too. It's been a little while for me, and I've been wanting to write about Massachusetts a lot. And now I can't stop. I wrote this, I'm writing something else in Massachusetts. And if the Writers Guild, if we can ever get a fair contract and the strike will end, that I'll be writing a TV series version of The Stolen Coast as well, that hey, I'm eager to get to work on. So I hope that the strike resolves, but we need a fair contract first. So, but I look forward to doing that once the strike is done.
Oh, wow. Congratulations. That's one of the questions, is about Hollywood and movie and TV projects.
Yeah. I mean, without getting into much detail about it, just because during the strike, we don't want to be promoting any of these things specifically, but it's fine to say that I'll be working on a pilot episode at some point in the future, once we have a good contract again. But it's really fun to get to imagine what the world of this town and these people and these eccentric characters, what it might look like as a TV series, has been kind of a fun exercise to get to do.
I'll bet. Yeah. Did you ever, we're always riffing off other authors, but love Laura Lippman's most recent work in particular, like the last four or five books she's done. And there was that book called Sunburn.
Yeah, it was like her James M. Cain.
Yeah,
it's funny. That's another one that, again, after I was done, I could see, because it's supposed to be, I think, Maryland, Delaware area. I think Delaware. And it's kind of this woman who has washed out of her own life and needs to start over somewhere, and goes to kind of a small beach town during a hot season and gets involved with a man there, and it's bad news. But, you know, it's got that very James M. Cain atmosphere. But it also is, you know, it's another example of one of these towns on the coast that kind of draw people to them when they want to start over. We somehow go towards the ocean when we want to start a new baby.
Yeah. Let's see. Someone's asking, is it by chance Fisher Island?
Oh, my island? Mine is Key Biscayne. I live on Key Biscayne, so just south of Fisher Island, directly south of Fisher Island.
Nice.
Yeah.
Let's see. Don just is saying how much she loves Alan First. And yeah, dude. he's great. Yeah. And also,
I got on a kick. I think I read, like, I don't know what it was, just, you know, that period in the very beginning of the pandemic when we weren't leaving and some of us got obsessive about certain things. I got obsessed with Alan First. And I think I read about 15 of them, just one after another. I couldn't stop. And I'm sure that that has formed some part of me as a writer tremendously. And I probably, if you look from the novel I'd written just before I read 15 Alan First novels to this one, I'm sure you can see some of his influence all over it.
Do you like Philip Kerr?
Yeah, another one. And you know, those like World War II era morally ambiguous situations are just so, you know, rich with atmosphere that I love that stuff.
Yeah, another one like that. And then we'll kind of take this in for a landing. But Simenon's book, you know, I love some of his, yeah. I like the McGrays, but some of the non-McGrays, like Dirty Snow.
Yeah, that's my colleague Molly Owens. That's always been her favorite. And she pushed at me. I think that was the first thing that she told me to read when we met, because I loved the Simenon, like the detective novels. And that's what I hadn't read the hard stuff, the noir, the deurs. And I love French crime fiction generally. And so I also am a big Simenon fan and have come around to those noirs. They're really good. And I think there are a lot of French writers and filmmakers that probably worked their way into this book. I love Manchette. Modiano is probably one of my favorite writers just in general. And then also all these movies, right? Like Melville movies I was watching at the time, or even like Bande à Part. And there are these heist and caper novels that have this real acerbic French wit to them. I love them so much. So I was watching a lot of that stuff at the time as well.
Yeah, I love Manchette. You know, that kind of reminds me, it was a more political Richard Stark, maybe.
Yeah, that's a really good comparison. Manchette is great. And the New York Review of Books editions that they put out of them are so cool. They just had a big sale on the other day, so I think I probably bought a couple more. Yeah, they had a flash sale on it that I think William Boyle, the author, had clued a couple of us in that they were doing a flash sale of the Manchette novels, which there's a very particular subset of us who, you know, have to run to our computers and get on top of that, give them as gifts to people.
I love what New York Review does. I mean, I would love to have a full set of those beautiful books that they do.
They're really pretty. They're great.
Yeah. And that, you know, they've done, you know, people like Don Carpenter and Kenneth Fearing and, you know, Dorothy B. Hughes and Patrick Hamilton, you know, is another totally neglected writer.
They're doing such good work with those. I mean, the same way that you guys have such a great series of classics as well, that I'm glad there are people out there to curate these things. You guys are like the Criterion Collection of classic mysteries, right?
Well, anyway, hey, it's been a real treat talking with you as always. We'd love to get you out here in person. So maybe.
No, I'm hoping. I was hoping that this year I would. I don't know if I could handle the heat that you guys are having. So I'm gonna come when it's below 100, we'll say.
You'll have to work on your release date, you know. So
I know.
July is good for some of the country, but not
the problem is these are summer books, you know. It's summertime. It's summertime on the coast in Massachusetts. So it's a natural release for July. I hope people will pick it up on their way to their beaches and their summer vacations towards the end of this month. But if I want to come to Arizona, it's a little difficult this month, I suppose. So I'll have to write a nice, cozy winter mystery. Yes,
that'd be great. Well, again, folks, thanks for tuning in. And somebody's asking about what do they do with the books? Oh, New York Review of Books. Yeah, that's a specific publishing company, and they do just these wonderful line of books. So there you have it. Yeah.
Well, thank you, Patrick, for having me. This is the conversation I look forward to with the books coming out. So I got to write another one quick so that we can have another conversation and we'll do it in person. But thank
That'd
you so
great.
Much.
If the paperback happens to come out off season, like in the winter,
exactly.
Come here.
All right. I'm in. All I'm right. there. This will be a treat. And thank you so much for having me.
Thank you. And thanks everybody for tuning in. Remember, we have signed copies. Grab one before they're gone. So take care. Congratulations on the book.
Thank you so much. Thanks, everyone.
Hello. We hope you're enjoying our programs and podcasts with authors. We'd like to expand them, and your help would be appreciated. Please make a donation at poisonedpenfoundation.org. 100% of the proceeds will go to help connect authors with readers in this difficult time. Thank you.